Greetings, Raised community. Brent coming in live today from New Haven, Connecticut. And I am so excited to welcome Nancy Jackson, who serves as Chief Development Officer at the Kansas University Endowment. And Nancy, we are recording this on a Thursday, and we're going to be hanging out at the Big 12 Development Conference next Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So get a lot of each other in the next week. I'm looking forward.
Lucky us.
As I start these episodes, it's also fitting because I think we were really getting to meet in person a year ago at the Big 12 Development Conference about 5 seconds before you accepted this role.
You're exactly right. I had actually accepted. I knew I was coming, but it was not yet public. So it was one of the most awkward conferences I've ever attended in my life because, of course, I was then with Generous Change and Jenna and I were there together and we both knew and most of our clients were in the room and we couldn't say anything. So you're right. Well,
if this philanthropy thing doesn't work out for you, try poker because you had us all fooled. Well done.
Thank you.
But let's talk more about your background. I love better understanding the higher education journeys personally of our guests, of folks who've become leaders in the field. And so take me back to junior year of high school. Who was that Nancy? What was she into? And what led you to UCLA?
Yeah. Junior year of high school, Nancy was elected to become a senator in Junior Statesman of America. I grew up in California, and it was like, I was really into politics and cheerleading, which anybody who knows me would know that that makes a ton of sense. And so UCLA was the obvious choice for me and the only place that I applied because as I was growing up, they always won the Rose Bowl. And that seemed like a really fun school to go to. I was really excited that I got in, Brent, because in the end, like there was all this news about the UC system being impacted and people with perfect scores and 4.0s were not getting in. And I was like, I'm going to have to like move to LA and fake it. But I got in. And then about halfway through my tenure at UCLA, which I loved every single day that I attended and felt so lucky to be there. It's an incredible university. My dad went front page of the paper bankrupt. Like it was a big thing. And I was going to be self-supporting for the rest of my college experience. My mother had moved from California to Kansas in a really strange twist. So I had residency in Kansas and I moved to KU and finished here. I was so lucky to be able to do that, graduate without debt because I could actually put myself through school here. And then I went back to California, worked for a while, never intended to come back.
Tell me more about that transition. So, I mean, first of all, thank you for your candor. It sounds like a really, you know, tough and public thing to have gone through. But then you've got this, you know, California, the California roots, you've got UCLA, it's going great. And so then you move, it's like we're not in California anymore, and you move to Kansas and you connect with all of the other politically active cheerleaders from the West Coast on campus? Like, how did that work?
Right, not so much. One of the big shocks, I think, about going from the experience that I had, which was awfully privileged and lucky. You know, I was in a sorority at UCLA. I had a really pretty apartment and a great car, and I was kind of living large. And when I came to KU, I sold the car to help pay for school, and I had two or three jobs at any given time. And my whole purpose was to get through school. I did have a great experience here. It's very different than UCLA, obviously, but I found my professors to be incredibly supportive, and I actually got more invested in and excited about the work that I was doing, the stuff that I was studying. And so it was a great experience. And when I graduated, I did hightail it back home, worked in both San Francisco and LA for a while. And so it was both an incredibly difficult transition to the Midwest. And honestly, I felt for the longest time that I didn't fit in at all. And both the political girl and the cheerleader girl were, you know, I was done with those. I was now working, like I was working all the time. And I would say that that has been in a lot of ways the defining feature. You know, coming up with new ways to do things that require a tremendous amount of learning on my part turned out to be kind of the hallmark of the rest of my life.
And so tell me about the immediate move back to the West Coast. What did you focus on? And then what did you lead you back to Kansas?
Yeah. So I started in investment banking. I worked for Montgomery Securities in San Francisco. Loved it. Corporate finance in the, late 80s, early 90s, what's not to like? It was a terrific exposure to kind of how the economy writ large really works. And I then moved down to LA to, hang out with a dude. And that was also tremendous. So I started actually at the Music Center for Los Angeles County. That was my first nonprofit job. So I was raising money for the symphony, two theater groups, the opera, and at the time the Joffrey Ballet was half of the year in LA. And that really got me into, managing volunteers and thinking about how to fundraise in really content-rich, connective ways. I was taught by women society ladies who were such pros. They were so incredible and they were so wholehearted in their support of these causes. They taught me a ton. Then I started grad school at USC. To pay for that, I went
Just for
back
a
to
second, for
yeah.
those who haven't spent as much time with society, ladies, what are like one or two generalizable lessons that we can all take from your window into that world?
Yeah. I think that there can be I think there can be a sense of dismissal sometimes for volunteers. Like we are the pros and they are the volunteers. We know the things they don't. I was so young and I knew what I didn't know. And so I was able to really watch them. And the things that I felt like I could really that I learned tremendously from them was how careful they were about everybody's time so that, they were making sure that we were preparing volunteers to succeed, to have great conversations. We were not assuming that they knew what to say. We were giving them everything they needed to be able to walk in the door and do a beautiful job. It reminded me that they hold the relationships, right? Not us. And that working with them and really developing close relationships with them was the most important conduit to their kind of crew. The other thing that I learned from them was really the value of preparation, the value of social connection and networks. And I think today, as we look forward in philanthropy, experience and community, I'm convinced, are going to be the key to our success. And both of those things were clear to me back in Los Angeles. Those women were so attendant to both. Now, that was, of course, an art center, so there was so much experience. But what they were connecting with one another on, the dismissal can sometimes be, oh, they're society ladies. It's the same that campus can sometimes do to development, like, oh, they're schmoozers, right? But nothing could be further from the case. And in their case, it was, we really, really care about the arts. And so we're connecting with these other, in this case, women, women connecting with women, another trend and interesting and important thing, on the content, on the arts, on what this does for society, on how important it is for children, right? And so for me, it couldn't have been a better preparation, really, for everything I've done since.
Love it. And so, a formative experience. What was your aspiration that led you to USC?
A great question. I wanted to do some world changing. I was volunteering in South Central Los Angeles. I was working with kids who were getting into graffiti art as a way out of gangs, and who were being very entrepreneurial in that space. And so I was really intrigued by what might be the possibility there. So I started my graduate degree in cultural anthropology, or no, cultural geography is what it was. And I was only there for 2 years. But it was a tremendous kind of window onto seeing social change instead of deciding from my perspective what needed to change, looking into a community and seeing the seeds of potential and possibility, and then figuring out how to lift that up and bring attention. So that's what brought me to USC.
Do you remember any specific moments with the kids who were doing the graffiti art, whether there were specific work that stood out or specific individuals that really moved you?
Yeah, so much. There was one kid in particular who he was really short. His growth was stunted because he was shot with a sawed-off shotgun at 10 years old in the stomach. And so he lived, which was incredible. And he was one of the most creative people I've ever known. His art, his graffiti art, was spectacular. I mean, the murals that he created were gorgeous, some legal, some illegal. And his poetry was exceptional. And so he, over time, I knew him for a series of months as we were kind of doing this work together. And he shared his journal, right? His notebook. And the words, the ideas, the lyricism, the whimsical view of the world coming from really rough circumstances. I was so inspired by that kid and just his tenacity and his creativity and his love of the world and his ability to create in the face of all kinds of obstacles. It was really inspiring.
Amazing. Sounds like he'd have millions of TikTok followers if he were
He would have, exactly right.
Hey. So nothing you've said so far leads me to believe that the next stop on your journey is back in Kansas to get a master's in environmental history. So how'd that happen?
You know, Brent, I ask myself that many, many days. The answer, which is embarrassing, and maybe this is a lesson for anybody who's listening that does this kind of thing. When I look back, I really am puzzled by why I would have done that. It's such a departure from you're right, everything I just said. My mother had married a guy who had started a nonprofit, the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas, that does incredible work in sustainability. They at the time were really rethinking agriculture. And so I was very kind of attentive to, somewhat inspired by the work that they were doing. One of his best friends was Donald Worster, who was one of the people that created the field of environmental history. He happened to be here at Kansas. I was reading him, I was reading others. I was torn between here and Yale. And I thought that by far the more affordable option for me would probably yet again be Kansas. I came here in the weirdest way. I think I was actually trying to please my mom, and I was working when I left. I was going to USC, but I was working for the Capital Group. So I was back in investment banking, but on the sell side instead of the buy side. And or the buy side instead of the sell side, excuse me. And my bankrupt dad, my mom was worried about me caring too much about money. This is ironic, right? Given what I now do. And so I think I was trying to overcorrect, and that is how I ended up at KU. And honestly, it wasn't the best experience in the world, but I did end up then taking what I had studied. I was able to move into publishing, scholarly publishing. It sounds so nerdy now, and it is, but I was so excited because I actually had the opportunity to shape the fields in which I had studied. And so I got to hang out with my intellectual heroes, and I got to work with people to make their books more digestible, more appealing, more impactful. So I've had the weirdest career trajectory in the entire world.
But you've planted roots in Kansas,
I
and
did.
California is out there somewhere. But tell me about the exposure, if any, that you had to the KU endowment, to philanthropy at KU. Was it front and center in your work in publishing, or was it sort of over there or completely off your radar?
It was over there. It was on my radar just because of my past. Certainly, it was in the news. KU Endowment makes a tremendous impact in this area. KU is one of the biggest employers in the entire state, right? So it's hard to live in Kansas and not be somewhat aware, I think, certainly in Lawrence, somewhat aware of KU Endowment. And what happened really was that I was a decade in publishing, and one day I got really mad and quit. And I thought to myself, what job could I do? And I applied over here, and I got that job, and then left to create a nonprofit, and then came back for 8 years, and then left to create Generous Change with Jenna, and then came back. So it's KU Endowment has ended up being both a really supportive place for me and a really remarkable place to grow and try new things, and obviously a magnet that kind of kept pulling me back.
So tell me about the initial transition into the work. Think about your first 30 days on the job where you're now a development director. What were you equipped with? What was the onboarding, or was it just go get them? I mean, tell me about the realities at that time.
I was equipped with nothing. I
Okay.
walked in the door, and this really is the genesis of Generous Change.
Like, tell me more about like truly what it means to be equipped with nothing. You show
What
up,
it meant.
you're like fired up for your first day on the job, and then what happens?
And it was, and so I was trained how to use the database in a sort of theoretical kind of way. Right. I wasn't even being trained on the database with the people that I needed to be reaching out to. Like, I was trained how to use the database, and our onboarding then, and somewhat still now, was go around and talk to all the people in all the divisions so you understand what everybody does. Now, that's useful in a certain sense, but in your first few days or weeks, you don't know how any of that is going to apply to you. So it's drinking from a fire hose without the ability to retain, because you haven't even built a structure in, on which to hang that knowledge. And so it was sort of okay. And then there was the database, but the database didn't give me any way within it to create a work plan. So I then created a spreadsheet, which I wasn't supposed to, because that's a shadow database. But how else do you like define your work, right? And then I just randomly started kind of going out to meet these people, and my travel was sort of scattershot and somewhat occasional. And honestly, I didn't understand that in order to get to the level of gift that I really needed to be pursuing, I needed to see those people several times a year. The people who preceded me had seen them one time a year. I was like, I guess that's how we do it. And that's not how you do it. Right. So I literally, I didn't have a good sense really of the overall like goal of the institution, nor did I have any sense of how I was supposed to individually contribute, nor did I was terrible. The worst thing, and I think almost everybody does this early, I would go and see people, and I felt like I had two goals: for them to like me so that they would see me again. When in fact, getting the next visit is never the goal, right? Understanding, is this person philanthropic? And if so, is their philanthropy going to be focused at KU?
So give me a 60-second, 2-minute, you call it role play of what that Nancy would sit down and say and try to accomplish during a meeting. And if you could go back over your shoulder, whisper in your ear, coach yourself up, how you would approach it today.
So at the time, I was raising money for the Spencer Museum of Art, which is a tremendous university art museum, and the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. And I would say, in both cases, what I was trained to do at the time was to walk in and say, "Tell me a little bit about your KU experience." And what that would lead to was a discussion about everybody's favorite wheel, or the Wheel in Lawrence, which is everybody's favorite bar as an undergrad, or Potter's Lake, or going to basketball games in Allen Fieldhouse, or whatever the case might be, none of which actually leads to a gift conversation, right? And so, and I thought that my goal, again, was basically, I kept being told this is about building relationships, right? But nobody really said, even though it should be obvious, you're here to raise some money, right? And so I knew how to make friends. I knew how to build relationships, and that's what I did. So I was getting the next visit. I was creating a group of people that would see me whenever I came to town, that were excited about KU, yes. But I was very reticent about actually asking for money, about actually bringing money into the conversation. So that was initially.
Let me just pause on that, and then we'll hear about how you'd approach it now. The one of my mentors is a guy named Mike Troiano, who's a chief marketing officer, historically now a venture capitalist. He was talking about his own philanthropic experience with Cornell University and other organizations that he's been a part of. And he said, you know, nostalgia is a crutch. Nostalgia is something that, you know, universities lean on. And it's the wheel at KU, and it's XYZ bar at every other university, and it's comfortable, but it is a crutch. And the second thing that stood out in what you were just describing is when people tell you it's a relationship business, I guess there's an element of, because in a certain sense, like the relationship is between the individual and the university, and that relationship already exists before you show up. And on a spectrum, it could be an amazing relationship or it could be a really terrible relationship. But that kind of has nothing to do with Nancy. And so there's an element of how do I figure out the quality of the relationship between this person and the university or between the endowment? And that's almost going to govern what kind of relationship needs to be built. Like, do they need a high level of trust and rapport and get to know Nancy, the person? Or are they actually far enough along in the quality of the relationship with the institution that is somewhat secondary? Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And I think there's a layer that I would add on to that, even Brent. I think that's exactly right. And then when you layer on what is an actual gift conversation, right? So Nancy today would because there's another crutch. You mentioned nostalgia as a crutch, and you're absolutely right. The other crutch that we all tend to lean on far too heavily is one pagers. Like brochures, documentation that we can kind of push across the table and that we sort of depend on to do our work for us, right? And instead, I think today Nancy would walk in and have far more provocative, curious questions. And instead of trying to give someone an update from campus, I would be asking, how did KU change your life? Right? How did your career start here? And if so, how? Or how did you get from, to take one real example, how did you get from being an anthropology major at KU to running global trials for Kantar Health, you know, that runs clinical trials for many, many pharmaceutical companies? Those kinds of questions get to much more interesting answers that help to convey both what you mentioned, Brent, which is what is the state of your relationship to the university, but also from a psychological perspective, they prime a person's mind for a much richer conversation. They get someone thinking about how did this place affect my life, right? And then from there, you can have a more philanthropic conversation.
I think the other risk when you talk about donor experience, though, especially for people that have been philanthropic over multiple years, right? The university is the same and they're the same. And then there's a whole bunch of development officers along the way. And if your first meeting with the new development officer is, tell me about your nostalgic history that you've already told three or four other people with. You know, you go through it, you go through the motions, people are fine with it. But I also think, and this is obviously where we get excited about, like, there's so much data where we already know about these people. What if you could walk in and say, hey, Nancy, I understand that your path to KU was atypical, that you had this experience with your father going bankrupt in a very public way, and that you didn't really, you know, have KU as your dream institution. But I understand that you have gone on to do X, Y, and Z, and that it's now a deep part of your life. And I just wanted you to know that I've done that work, I've done that research, and I'd rather, you know, spend our time today on who you are now and where you want to go in the future. So that it's like you almost flip the whole conversation. And certainly we think that's where, you know, AI capabilities are going to hopefully not make the donor repeat themselves. And frankly, enable the fundraiser to understand more about who the person is and their past, so we can spend more time in the future.
Couldn't agree more, Brent. I think that is exactly the promise of AI, and that the I think it honors the donor for us to walk in having done our homework. I think a lot of people feel creepy about that because they feel like a yeah.
I think it's like we pride ourselves in creating a seamless handoff. It's inevitable that fundraisers are going to change and get promoted and move and switch jobs. That shouldn't create a break in this relationship. And so we have done our work. We take meticulous notes and we make sure that that's available so that you don't have to retell your story 10 times. And obviously there's going to be an element of rapport building, and I'm not saying that we just skip all of that, but that maybe that first meeting could be a lot more material.
I agree, and I think that what that allows the fundraiser to do is to start by doing what we all know is right, but our traditional practice doesn't always do, which is make it about the donor, right? The very first note is about the donor and shows that you have knowledge about them because you've cared enough to find out. And the conversation is peppered by smart, informed questions that make some sense. So it really it also flips that table from Dear Brent, my name is Nancy Jackson. I'm the senior vice president for blah, 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 blah. You know, it makes it about them from the beginning, and it keeps it about them and what their connection, you're exactly right, what their connection to the institution is and what their big dreams could be there. Because we haven't always been great at getting to that conversation quickly.
Yeah. Well, and that's another example where I recently had a conversation with Nick Lindy at the University of Nebraska, and he was talking about just as new fundraisers start, there's so much to learn. I mean, this is a university. It has countless departments and divisions and faculty member doing specific research in specific areas and athletics and activities and museums. It is literally impossible for any one person to know, to even go an inch deep on all of those topics. But I think that's where it should be really, really easy for artificial intelligence to go to mi a mile deep on all of those topics. And so that as the fundraiser, if you can spend time gathering the nuance that isn't available in a Google search, if you can understand who somebody is and what they care about today, we should then be able to mash that up against everything going on at a university so that there might be a faculty member doing really specific work that aligns with this really unique interest, where the fundraiser isn't coming back and like Googling your own website, which it sounds like is the case in a lot of situations. And so I think that's where I'm hopeful we can just spend a lot more time on the authentic relationship building and the closing process or the stewardship process, and less time Googling the donor and Googling our own websites.
And that I think you put your it, like it, that's absolutely hitting the nail on the head, right? So when it comes down to what is the most important asset that any organization like KU Endowment has, it's our people. It's our people's time, right? That's where all of our budget is. That's where all of our investment is, and that's where all of our expertise is. And so I think university fundraising is one of those places that is going to exemplify how the use of artificial intelligence allows us to be more human, right? Allows us to spend our time on the part. So machines do the part that we should not be spending our time on, so that the relationship and being the most robust conduit between that person and the university as we can be is where we're spending our time. So I could not agree more. I think the kind of time saving and the kind of targeting, right? So think about how much time we're spending right now just deciding who to see, just that, and how to map it. Who is seeable in a day? Being able to have artificial intelligence do all of that and say, oh, hey, you want to go to San Francisco? Here are the six people that you should see, and here's how you organize that.
I
That's
couldn't agree more.
hours and hours and hours back to doing the thing.
So let's talk about the human element and what inspired you to found Generous Change, because obviously you lived some of these challenges by way of your onboarding experience or lack thereof. And then as you advanced through your career, you saw other people come and go. And at some point, you know, it's one thing to sort of feel like there's an opportunity or a need. It's another thing to take the first step. And so what was like your aha moment, if there was one, or what was the catalyst to go from, oh, I'm really frustrated by X, Y, and Z, which so are lots of other people that work in this field, but you actually said, I'm going to hang a shingle at least part time and do something about it.
Yeah. So when I was last AVP here, Assistant Vice President for Strategic Development, the college, which I had previously led, was being led by Jenna Goodman. So we had worked together in the college, and then she was leading the college. And we had had a situation in which we hired someone who was an experienced fundraiser. And the whole reason we hired that person instead of the other one was experience. And we checked those references, and they were golden. And then that person could not get out the door. They set up their office beautifully and they liked their colleagues and they were delightful, but they just would not have visits with donors and not nearly at the volume that we needed. Then we were obsessed. That person left. In replacing that person, we actually had two positions at the same time and we became obsessed with how do we help these people to succeed, right? How do we do a better job than we did? And one of the things that we became obsessed with was we're sending the wrong email. It sounds so simple, and it is. But we were saying, you know, lots of people still are. Dear Brent, I am Nancy Jackson, the Senior Vice President for Development. The Chancellor has these goals. I'd love to come and meet you and give you an update on the university. Nobody responds to that. Well, some do, but few, right? And not the people we most want. And so we just flipped it on its head, created a different kind of email. We went to CASE. We were like, everybody should do this. We went to CASE, it was snowing. We didn't think we'd have anybody in the room. We literally brought 40, 40. We brought 40 photocopies of the thing that we had worked up. Ugly photocopies. The room was standing room only. There were a kajillion people there in a snowstorm.
Do you remember the title of the session? Like
I
what was
don't. I think
it?
we called it like, I think we called it How to Succeed in Fundraising. Like, I don't know, would I go to that? People did. And so we present this crazy thing with our ugly photocopies. And people, there was, I can say who it is because he would say who it is, Jake Logan, who was on your podcast not long ago. Jake was then at Mizzou, came literally ran up the aisle at that conference to talk to us. And he was like, I need to, you know, we need to talk. And you know, people were throwing their business cards at us and saying, you ran out of photocopies. Can you send me this photocopy? And Jenna and I left that thinking, holy moly, like there's a pressing need for this. We've been thinking a lot about this. And exactly as you say, our intent was to do it as a side gig. You know, I came back, told my boss, hey, we're going to do this side thing. We'll still meet all of our goals. We're just super excited about it. And then ultimately we left and did it.
That is amazing. They
It was amazing.
call those minimal viable products in the software world, and it can be as simple as a one page, you know, modestly designed photocopy. And I absolutely love that. Like if you hadn't brought that photocopy, done that session, it doesn't happen.
Exactly right.
And so that is the minimum viable product, although we're going to teach you to send an email. Doesn't seem like there's quite enough there for a long consulting business, or that could get copy and stolen pretty quickly. So when you went to kind of formally build out the model, how would you summarize the problem you were trying to solve and what the kind of package or the components of the solution were or are? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what we tried to think through was where were all, where, not all, where were some of the key missing steps in how to be a really successful fundraiser that we hadn't had and that we knew that other staffs didn't have either, right? And in all kinds of nonprofits. And so the email was one, the cold call was another. You know, what we had found was so many of our team just didn't want to pick up the phone. They just did not. And I get that because nothing is harder than that stink and cold call. But we also know that it's really critical, right? And so really kind of working on that, working on great questions to ask, upending, the traditional, I'm going to push across the dean's priorities and et cetera. So there were all these different how to write. This sounds silly because, and everyone who knows me will laugh at this because I'm the worst. How to write a better contact report. I write good contact reports. I just don't enter them like I should. And one of the things that we really wanted to focus on is if you start from a really phenomenal design of a contact report, and our thing was there are only three elements to a gift: timing, amount, purpose. So put those at the front of your contact report. When do they want to give? How much do they want to give? What's the change they want to make? Right? So that you just stay front of mind. And what we found was in practice, the better people did contact reports, the better they framed their conversations to begin with. Right? So it seemed like just a silly record-keeping thing, but it wasn't. It literally framed what people were trying to do in their visit. So we took a lot of these kind of pain points and put them all together into a training that was sort of a fundraising 101. That grew then into how do we support academic leaders in telling really spectacular stories, because we all know that that's what we need to be. We as fundraisers don't need to have the goals straight so much as we need to be able to tell the impact investment will make and why it matters now. And we just as a whole university community, we're not always great at that. So we did some work there. We ended up working with boards of trustees and on the same thing, how to be a spectacular volunteer, how to be a champion for the university. So it just kind of it really grew organically from what every people we literally we did a management mastermind, grew from working with a team who then said, this is great, but we need help with how to reinforce this and keep it alive in the organization. So we were kind of creating what we were asked for, by our clients. It was a very cool, wonderful learning process that's kind of and with a cajillion failures along the way, but
So tell me about some of the before and after stories that you're most proud of, and then ways that you're working that philosophy into your new role, if we can still call it new, at KU.
yeah, it still feels pretty new. I'm almost a year in. One of my favorite sort of success stories, there are several, obviously, but one of mine was we worked with the University of Maryland at College Park, and they first we did Fundraisers University with them. So we worked with all their fundraisers on the kinds of things that I just mentioned. And then we did Management Mastermind with them just almost maybe 6 months later. That process, which we did all on Zoom. This was during the pandemic, so it was weird and awesome actually. So that process of Management Mastermind was about helping supporting the team and identifying what would make the biggest change for them and how they wanted to pursue it and how they're going to do it. One of the key topics that we talked about was a different approach to reviews and goal setting that would be tremendously supportive in a very tailored kind of way, and ultimately would add up to raising a lot more money, right? And so this was a long, really great, engaged conversation. And then University of Maryland went off and lived their life for about 6 months. And Jenna and I were like, oh, we don't know if we really got there. We don't know if they came to their conclusions. They had wanted consistency. They wanted to focus on excellence, and we just weren't sure. And then we got a call from Jim, and he wanted to talk like 6 months later. And we genuinely thought, is he going to tell us that that really stunk and we should never do it again? And instead, he called and said, can't thank you enough. We have just in the time since Management Mastermind focused so heavily on becoming a culture of celebration that we have really changed the feeling. Like, just the vibe here is different than it was. Additionally, we worked because one of their complaints was, we'll never be allowed to do this review thing because campus HR just won't. They'll just say no. They've said no to everything. So he says, we've changed. We're really celebratory. People are feeling better. And we went to campus HR And not only did they allow us to change our review system, but now ours is a model for theirs. And it was
Amazing.
one of those sort of, oh my gosh, right? Just a little support, a little bit of a forum to have those big conversations. And I think that's the biggest thing that I take into the practice here is it's so easy, especially in campaign when you have a really lofty goal, it's so easy to keep your head down and have your blinders on and do the work because there's a lot of it to do. But I think giving smart, amazing humans a forum to have big ideas and experiment and think of what could be possible is what ultimately keeps an org. I mean, you guys are so great at this, right? But what ultimately keeps an organization healthy and vibrant. And so one of the things that I've been happiest to create at Endowment is, well, I mean, really, it's my team that's created it, but to foster is our own management forum where everybody who manages frontline fundraisers is coming together to really imagine and discuss how we can better support our people and how we can enrich our practice and how we can celebrate results. And that has been already a game changer, and I'm really excited to see where it goes.
So, given your experience building generous change, and then also having, worked with, I'm sure, multiple vendors and partners over the years, like what advice would you give me or other folks working in the space based on both what worked really well for you at Generous Change, but also what you've seen either go well or go poorly in other vendor relationships?
Yeah, it's a good question, Brett. And I think you all are really good at it. I think that one of the things that's most valuable, I mean, you all are terrific at having check-ins with us and talking about what's working and what can be improved both on your side and ours. And I think that that candor and that, just imagination of how things can be better has been, we really value it. I mean, I think you guys are a fantastic partner in that way. I also feel like you've really listened. I mean, we're so lucky to work with Jake, who of course used to work with us. And, he's been terrific at really listening and responding with a solution. And I think that that's rare in the vendor world. I think that there's a lot of and I can say in other relationships, even currently, there when concerns are expressed, the concerns will be heard, not necessarily acted upon, right? And so I think that you all have been great about that. And then I think the other place that Evertrue has been really spectacular from beginning to now is really thinking about where is the industry going? And I mean, exactly as you've been saying with artificial intelligence, here's this bright, shiny thing that would be a little easy to look away from because a lot of people are scared of it. But to really look at it and be able to describe, I mean, there's that old story about Steve Jobs saying, nobody knows they need an iPhone, but they will see that they need it, right? Which we did. We all did. And I think that you all have been great about doing that in the AI space and really being and really planting in our imaginations the ways in which it could transform our practice so that we can do the more human part. So I would say in all of those ways, you all are exemplifying what it means to genuinely partner. And I would say that's the biggest thing. For all vendors, and we saw this ourselves at Generous Change, is that it's easy to see yourself as providing a service, and you do. When it switches over to genuine partnership, then you have clients who are going to stick with you for a long, long time, right? Because you're creating something together that both parties value.
I really appreciate all of that, and it certainly reflects the spirit with which we try to approach this. I think one of the real areas that I still struggle with is how prescriptive should we be? And there was a period, early on where I knew nothing about development. Like I knew maybe enough to be modestly dangerous. And now through lots of experience and conversations like this one and exposure to what's worked and what hasn't, I feel like there are opportunities for us. And I think this is where you really articulated this well at Generous Change, is providing prescriptive guidance. And there's this balance of, hey, who are these folks at Evertrue? Who do they think they are that they're telling us how to do our job versus that is how we should be doing our job, and they're equipping us. And so there's, because there are times where, you know, when I think about relationships that haven't gone well, the initial premise of like, hey, for example, you have alumni that are getting really big promotions. We need to create a career stewardship model that takes that signal of a promotion, converts it into a conversation. Worst case scenario, you're making people feel really good and heard and recognized. Best case scenario, you're getting a conversation. You're learning about their story, right? It's a discovery visit. Maybe there's career services links. Maybe there's corporate foundation experiences, but we'd be crazy to not have a systematic approach to career stewardship the same way that we do to giving stewardship. And when I say that to leaders, not a single time has somebody said, nah, I just agree to disagree. Every time people light up at the concept, but then operationalizing that requires us to be pretty hands-on and pretty prescriptive. And I think sometimes, you know, there's the challenge of like the leader might be totally fired up, but then when that is delegated, it just doesn't quite connect. And so I think that's where we're, you know, kind of the spirit of like, how do we push you? How do you push us without being pushy?
Yeah, no, I love that. And I think, and this is something that we're thinking about a lot internally too, because we've made lots and lots of changes in my first year here. It's been turbulent and uncomfortable, as change often is, always maybe. And one of the big things that I've come to, and a big lesson from Generous Change, I think, is, and again, I think you all are really good at this already, but I think a couple of things. It's pitching something in a way that makes the need obvious. And that example you gave is golden, right? Who doesn't want that? We all want to congratulate our alumni on their promotions. That's a genius moment. And in the less obvious ways, right? I think, I mean, Generous Change, we were asking people to do a lot of things differently that were not that fun to change, right? And so in that case, it was being able to show two things. One, data. This is what's worked for others. You guys are great at that. Two, to be able to say, hey, here are some standout things that our clients have said to us that have changed the game for them, right? These are a few game-changing options, even if they're hard. And then to be able on the operationalizing side, which is again, we're deep in this right now internally, what I've come to learn or embrace maybe. Is how incredibly important it is after that first meeting. And again, y'all do this, but as a matter of practice, okay, let's say it's me and I say, Brent, we got to have this. Like this congratulating alumni thing is the bomb. How do we do it? And then the answer back to me probably needs to be, okay, who are all the people that would be any part of implementing this? And let's have a kickoff meeting. Where we help you from the jump to operationalize who does what and how it can be a part of their role. Because what I've learned is so many of us, we are an organization, you know this, Brent, that did not change for a very long time. You know, and not just our organization, I mean, the entire industry sort of did things the way they did them. And I'm not sure innovation is so much in our fabric. But I know that it's in our people, right? So our people want to move, want to change, want to do the next big thing. And you all have been amazing in partnering with our DXO team, right? And sort of donor engagement writ large. And I just wonder if maybe that kind of engagement can be replicated. Like you helped us create that, right? We wouldn't have that team without you. And I think that that probably needs to happen in other ways too, because I think there can be a tendency to think people know how to make a thing work. And what I've learned in the last year is they don't. They can, but they need to have a structure and a support.
Yeah, so I think having what I'm hearing, and this is somewhat reminiscent to your one page handout, is have it not just a hypothetical, exciting concept, but write it down into a step-by-step process. Ensure that process is understood, and then identify the key stakeholders that would be required to implement that process, get them in a room, align on what you plan on doing for phase one, and then have the guardrails in place to ensure that you get there. And I think that's where, even with some of our regular check-ins, and this is something I hope we can change, is that it's not just a look back of the last quarter, but realigning around, have we operationalized the things we were all excited about? And if not, why not? If so, let's celebrate that.
Yeah.
But let's not just sort of keep highlighting the hypothetical cool things that you could do, because once that Zoom call ends or once the meeting ends, people are back to their inboxes, they're busy. And so introducing new topics, especially when you're getting something started, requires that kind of, you know, hands-on collaboration you're describing.
Yep.
I love it. All right. Well, that gives me some homework to go back and check. We are at time. Give me the elevator pitch though for what's going on at the KU Endowment. Are you hiring? If people want to learn more, I know you're active on LinkedIn. I mean, what's the best way to stay connected?
Yep. LinkedIn is always great. And my email is njackson@kuendowment.org. So that part is easy. Reach out anytime. We do have a couple positions, not very many right now, I'm really happy to say. And I think that, you know, as we gear up, we've just launched a $2.5 billion campaign. And I feel like not only are we looking to succeed there, but we're looking to use this campaign in many ways to build the foundation for the next, which of course will be much larger. And so we're reinventing everything right now. We're reinventing the way we do communications. We're reinventing our stewardship operation. We're thinking really hard about how we do annual giving and how we can acquire more donors that way. We're looking at, we've rethought the way that we're traveling as a major gift team. We've stood up a development analytics group. We have a long way to go there in learning how to really be data led in the way that we fundraise. And so what I would most love, I love these conversations with you and with your team. And I would love to see all of us create a more vibrant and ongoing community of conversation around where this industry is heading and how we can collectively lead it in a really exciting direction, right? Because I think that operating in a vacuum in an insular kind of way is very tempting. It's not productive, right? So how do we, conferences are so great, but they're just these little injections in time. And how do we kind of begin to foster long-term conversations that take us where we need to go?
I love it, Nancy. Great thoughts to conclude with, even if we don't have the answer today. Maybe we can catch up on that topic at the cocktail hour next week. How's that sound?
Sounds great.
Well, with that, I'm going to conclude today's episode with Nancy Jackson, who serves as Chief Development Officer at the Kansas University Endowment. Thank you, Nancy, and take care, everybody.
Thanks, Brent. Such a treat.